We recently finished a long series on one of the chapters or fascicles of Dogen Zenji's kind of collected works called the Shobo Genzo on continuous practice. It went quite well, I thought. Very interesting. And then last weekend we had a weekend retreat, sat all day Saturday, sat through Sunday, and then on Sunday afternoon we had a Jukai ceremony, a precept ceremony for five people who recently, after a year of studying the precepts, received a Buddhist name and kind of like what I'm wearing, a miniature Buddhist robe, a rakusu. And if you were able to join us in person or on Zoom, you'll know that we conducted this ceremony not here, but at the Vancouver Buddhist Temple, which is not far from here. It's on Jackson Street, right across from Oppenheimer Park. And the head priest there is Reverend Aoki. In the years that I taught at SFU, there were occasions where I would bring my students there to the Vancouver Buddhist Temple for field trips. And I've given talks there at their yearly Buddhist study series, which is a public event spread over several weeks, introducing various Buddhist schools of Buddhist practice. And Reverend Aoki knows both Kate and me and has really been very supportive of Mountain Rain over the years. Last year, for example, we had an ordination ceremony there. It's much larger than here, very beautiful inside. So a few weeks, or actually more than that, about a month or more before we had our Jukai ceremony, we realized this space is too small. And we inquired about using again the Vancouver Buddhist Temple, since they had kindly let us use it for the ordination. And the temple board there and Reverend Aoki immediately agreed to let us hold our Jukai ceremony in the Hondo, or the kind of main worship hall, even though they had another event planned for that afternoon. They thought they could squeeze us in, so worked very well. After the ceremony, though, several people asked me about that temple, so I thought tonight I would talk a little bit more about that temple and about the practice that happens there. It's a temple that was and is largely for the Japanese Canadian community. The early Japanese immigrants to Canada in the late 1800s and early 1900s were largely members of the Japanese Buddhist stream called Jodo Shinshu. and I'll explain a little bit more about Jodo Shinshu in just a moment. But way back in 1905, they sponsored a priest from Japan to come. And I believe he was either the first or certainly among the first Buddhist priests to come and live in Canada. In the next year, 1906, they were able to buy some property on Alexander Street, and they built a temple there, and the Japanese community grew. But during World War II, all Canadians of Japanese descent were evacuated from the West Coast and put into camps in the interior of BC or else sent to sugar beet farms in Alberta and Saskatchewan. The Alexander Temple was lost. many of the Japanese properties were sold by the government to pay for their internment, for the food and the building of the internment camps. So the temple was lost, and it wasn't really until 1951 that Japanese Canadians were finally allowed to return to the West Coast. And many decided not to after their experience of being evacuated from the West Coast. But some did. And a few years after 1951, the Japanese community managed to buy the Methodist Church building, which is on Jackson Street, the present site of the Vancouver Buddhist Temple. And they gradually built up, and then they kind of redid the temple, made it more useful for them in the 70s. It used to be called the Vancouver Buddhist Church. And if you were there during the ceremony, or you have seen it perhaps on Zoom, the overall design is much like a Western church inside. There are pews, people sit on pews, there's a big altar that you face, there's an organ. It was all in an effort to blend into Canadian society after their experience of World War II. They tried to make the structure and the various events that happened in the Japanese Buddhist Church, as it was called at that time, really fit or be very similar to what you might find in a Christian church. And the temple also functioned largely as a community center. There's a large gym there, dances were held, apparently a lot of engagements happened in those dances as young people got to know each other, hang out together. There's a big communal or a big commercial kitchen. They often have food and serve meals together, big dining hall. So the tragic story of what happened to the Japanese Canadian community before and during and after World War II is pretty complicated and painful in its way. But I think we should be aware of its history. And there are lots of documentaries that you can get from the library here. NHK has several really good documentaries on what happened to the Japanese Canadians at that time, and also the lingering effects that are still felt today. As I mentioned earlier, the Vancouver Buddhist Temple belongs to the Japanese school of Buddhism called the Jodo Shinshu, which literally translates as true Pure Land religion. True Pure Land religion. And it's really not possible to give a full explanation of the kind of rich teachings and practices of the Jodo Shinshu, because it has at least an 800-year history in Japan, and even deeper roots that go back to Southeast Asia at a time when Southeast Asia, a lot of the sutras or writings were being produced, including what are known today as the Pure Land Sutras or the Pure Land texts of the Buddhist tradition. But I'm going to give you a thumbnail sketch of the Jodo Shinshu as best I can. First of all, here's a quote from the Jodo Shinshu website, Canadian website. "The teachings of Jodo Shinshu share with all people a way to mindfully realize the true reality of human existence and to live a fulfilled life grounded on something more profound and essential than mere happiness and unhappiness. With the guidance of Amida Buddha." When I read that, I thought, that's kind of revolutionary. grounded on something more profound and essential than happiness and unhappiness. I mean, don't we kind of base our lives on happiness and unhappiness? And they're saying, no, there's something more essential. Amida Buddha, they say. Well, the Mahayana Buddhist tradition has many Buddhas who represent principal roles or principal roles within the Buddhist sutras, and often they represent certain qualities, including, for example, Maitreya Buddha, the future Buddha, the Buddha to come in future times, Vajraya, Vairochana Buddha, who represents radiant enlightenment and wisdom. And another example is Amida or Amitabha Buddha, who is the Buddha of the Pure Land Sutras. And I'll explain a little bit more about them in just a moment here. But within the Pure Land, there are three really important sutras or texts that they hold as central. So again, I'll come back to that in just a moment. There was a monk, Shinran Shonin, who lived roughly at the same time as Dogen Zenji. So roughly 1200s, very late 1100s to early 1200s, who is recognized today as the founder of Jodo Shinshu. And like Dogen, he rejected the kind of scholarly and esoteric focus of Buddhism at that time. Buddhism at that time in Japan was really connected with theistocracy and elaborate rituals and kind of detailed doctrinal analysis and things like that. Both Dogen and Shinran really strived to create an understanding and practice that was open to everybody. And particularly Shinran felt this was most important. And he found his answer, because he spent many years as a monk wandering, trying to find a deep answer to this question. He found his answers in the Pure Land Sutras. So here's the kind of teachings that they emphasize. The teachings of Jodo Shinshu really focus on Amida Buddha as the light of boundless compassion. And Amida Buddha is also called the Buddha of infinite light and eternal life. Infinite life represents wisdom illuminating the darkness of our own ignorance. And eternal life represents the deep compassion that is always present for us. Because, as it says in the sutras, as long as there are sentient beings caught in the wheel of suffering, Amida is the compassionate force. Amida represents this compassionate force that will endlessly strive to end suffering and help all awaken to their true nature. That's kind of beautiful, isn't it? Amida. And maybe I'll just say a word here. In a little bit, like I'm trying to explain all of Christianity. Just kind of think of it like that. So don't take this as a gospel, as they say. Amida is both understood in one way as a Buddha who is there to help each other, help people, and also understood as this undefinable, almost unimaginable, compassionate energy calling forth everyone to realize their true nature. So in one of the Pure Land Sutras, it's a story of a bodhisattva called Dharmakara, who many eons ago made 48 vows and meditated and worked for countless eons to fulfill all those 48 vows. Of the 48 vows, the 18th vow is deemed the most important, because that vow goes like this: upon my attainment of Buddhahood — this is Dharmakaya speaking before he becomes a Buddha — upon my attainment of Buddhahood, if sentient beings in the 10 quarters, in other words, everywhere, north, south, east, west, up and down throughout the universe, if sentient beings in the 10 quarters who have a sincerity of heart, hold faith, and wish to be born in my pure land, repeating my name, perhaps up to 10 times, would not be born there, then may I not obtain great enlightenment. And upon fulfillment of the 48 vows, Bodhisattva Dharmakaya became known as Amitabha Buddha, a manifestation of truth in the universe. So this story of Dharmakara is understood in different ways, but the commonality that I sense is that underneath the ups and downs of our turbulent life is a caring reality. And in the Jodo Shinshu, that caring, compassionate reality is personified as Amida Buddha. That 18th vow that I mentioned, the creation of pure land for all of those who call upon Amida, is described by Shinran, the founder of this particular school, the Jodo Shinshu. Shinran describes it like this: a land of immeasurable light, a land of all-knowing wisdom, infinite space, vast and boundless. In some ways, it seems to overlap perhaps some of the descriptions of Buddha nature: vast and boundless, infinite light, an all-knowing wisdom. This 18th vow is known as the primal vow of Amida. And this next part is interesting. It's known as this because it's concerned with those who do not have the capacity to meditate, who do not have the capacity to undertake challenging practices. It's concerned with those who are weak, who are caught in challenging situations, who maybe despair of any hope of awakening. Shinran wrote this in one of his writings: when we entrust ourselves in Amida's primal vow, we who are like broken tiles and bits of rubble are transmuted into gold. So my sense is, in the Jodo Shinshu, the understanding is that this boundless compassion illuminates our own darkness and transforms our hindrances. It's not so much our own efforts. It's something beyond us. And the natural response to this boundless compassion that inspires everyone to act with deep appreciation for their life, and of course, is gratitude. Thank you. And this leads us to the very central practice of Jodo Shinshu, is the resuscitation, or the repeating, of what's known as Nenbutsu. Nen means to be mindful of, Butsu means Buddha, mindful of Buddha. In this case, it's Amida Buddha. In Japanese, it's Namo Amida Butsu. Maybe you could translate that as I take refuge in Buddha. I take refuge in Amida Buddha. Namo Amida Butsu. So, in the Pure Land tradition, this is understood as an outward verbal expression of thanksgiving and gratitude in the very presence of boundless compassion. So here's how one Jodo Shinshu teacher talks about Nenbutsu, explains it a little bit. He writes, Namu refers to I, the seeker. And Amida Butsu, of course, refers to Amida Buddha. When the seeker trusts fully and awakens to Amida, the seeker and Amida become one. This oneness is embodied in the expression of Namo Amida Butsu. So, this can be translated as Amida and I are one. Namo Amida Butsu. And then this teacher goes on to say something like, to use an ocean metaphor, it's like when a swimmer experiences the oneness when they completely trust the ocean. Not fighting the ocean, but just swimming with the ocean. Now, Nick's not here. She's one. Any other ocean swimmer? Cold water? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Trusting the water. However, it's not the number of times that the Nenbutsu is voiced, like 10 times, 100 times, 1,000 times. It's not even the purity of heart that's involved. But it is what they call deep hearing of the name that calls, to which we respond. I was not quite sure what that meant at first. The deep hearing of the name, and the name refers to Amida. I think what they're saying is this. This deep compassion that at least is called Amida in this case, this deep compassion calls to us, awakening us to our interconnection with all things. Opening to this experience of deep hearing, of actually awakening to, we are being pulled, called constantly, wake up. See the truth of your life. So this experience of deep hearing brings about a fundamental change in one's life. Equanimity and freedom in the midst of worldly entanglements, daily responsibilities, and constant agitations. One of the key messages of Shinran, and indeed all the teachers of Jodo Shinshu, is that this path, this Jodo Shinshu path, is the path for everyone, and especially lay people, because the Nenbutsu path has no requirements other than a willingness to open to the presence of deep compassion. Shinran wrote, "We should know that Amida's primal vow does not discriminate whether one is young or old, good or evil, and that true entrusting alone is needed. For it is the vow, in other words, it is Amida, or this compassion, that seeks to deliver sentient beings burdened with foolishness and blind compassions." And Shinran went on to write, "Even a good person attains birth in the Pure Land. So it goes without saying that an evil person will. I don't think evil is perhaps the best translation, but could we say even a deluded person will? So I was thinking, perhaps we could use this view of Nenbutsu, this remembering of Buddha, this practice of opening up to something larger than ourselves, to look at our own practice in a slightly different light. Most of us wish to be really quick learners, and really understand things and apply them like that, right? Like to sit on the cushion, wiggle my butt, and enter a deep meditative state. However, Shinryu Suzuki, the Japanese priest who brought this form of practice from Japan to North America, in his writing really cautions us against this attitude. He states in his wonderful book, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, this. Almost all of us want to be the best horse. If it's not possibly the best one, we want to be the second best. This, I think, is the usual understanding of Zen. And he's referring to a story about one, you know, I won't go into the story, but you get the idea, right? Everyone wants to be the best. You want to be the best horse if you're racing. He said, you may think that when you sit in Zazen, you will find out whether you are one of the best horses or one of the worst ones. Here, however, is a misunderstanding of Zen. If you think the aim of Zen practice is to train you to become one of the best horses, you will have a big problem. This is not the right understanding. If you practice Zen in the right way, it does not matter whether you are the best horse or the worst one. Well, that's a relief. What is he telling us here? I think he's warning us not to treat our Zen practice as a kind of commodity, as something we will get good at, something we will achieve. Because if we do, then it becomes almost like everything else in our lives. I mean, isn't your yoga practice to become good at yoga? The best, maybe, in the class? Shinryu Suzuki and Shinran are pulling us in a different direction. Shinryu Suzuki in the Shinryu Suzuki tradition and in Dogen's tradition, to view Zen practice as one more thing to master, one more thing to get, is ultimately not helpful, because it is that small ego self, that self-centered self, that's trying to push us to get awakening, our imagined awakening. And in that, just confusion arises. So the Jodo Shinshu practice of Nimbutsu and that view of compassion, this compassionate force that holds us, carries us, reaches out to us, it's really another perspective or way, I think, to approach our Buddhist practice. In this perspective, our intent is not striving for some distant awakening, but bringing to mind a remembering of our wholeness in this moment. Bringing to mind the compassion that is already here. And perhaps this can free us a bit from the ego pushing for some kind of strong experience in meditation, or the critical mind telling us, well, we're doing it wrong or poorly. Where's my samadhi? I've been sitting here for an hour. I think the teaching we can take from this perspective, is that we can trust. We can trust in the wisdom and compassion that has always been at the center of our lives. Even when we cannot see it clearly. And that is Dogen's view as well. Practice and awakening are not two things. They're both here. Or as Kate told us when we were doing a continuous practice awakening and actualization. They're not three separate things. All here. Now. I think this view that Dogen and Chunin share, in a way, perhaps most importantly, opens us to gratitude. To be open to gratitude is when we stop trying to manipulate our life. Be present to the beauty and the grace that is already here. As I said, the practice in the Jodo Shinshu, the Nembutsu, the Namo Amida Butsu, is not like a red Tesla, Namo Amida Butsu. A red Tesla, Namo Amida Butsu. A nice car, nice house. It's just gratitude. Thank you. We, I think, overall in our practice, don't turn to gratitude often enough. I don't. Sometimes I wake up, oh, I look out the window where we sit and have breakfast, Kate and I see the trees. We have a hummingbird feeder. I see this hummingbird come. And sometimes I remember, oh, thank you. What a beautiful world. So the Jodo Shinshu practice is encouraging us over and over again, wake up to the gratitude. Wake up to the compassion and wisdom that's here. Well, thank you for listening. I think I'll stop here. There's so much more they could say. And as I said, it's like trying to explain all of Christianity in a half hour.
Just pass the chant books. And the chant we are going to use is on page 17.
Can you see if you can find the chant? On the the book there and post it for people.